Mormon Stories Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation. All donations to Mormon Stories are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonstories.org.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Mormon Stories Podcast. I'm your host, John DeLynn. We are recording this interview both in audio form and also in video form. We're going to be posting it to YouTube at youtube.com/Mormon Stories. But today we have with us Dr. Brian C. Hales. Dr. Hales is an anesthesiologist living in the Salt Lake area. And he's also a noted author. But the topic of today's presentation is a response to Grant Palmer's claims of sexual allegations against Joseph Smith. Before we dig into that, I just want to talk to you a little bit about Brian. Brian, as I mentioned, is the author of several books, The Priesthood of Mormon Polygamy, Modern Polygamy and Mormon Fundamentalism, and Setting the Record Straight, Mormon Fundamentalism. Those are three books that he's published. He also is the owner of two websites. One's called MormonFundamentalism.com, and the other is JosephSmithsPolygamy.com. You can see the URLs on the YouTube presentation, but we'll post those as well on the Mormon Stories Facebook post up on MormonStories.org. But one of the most exciting things about Brian is that he's about to release, along with Greg Coford Books, a three-volume series on Joseph Smith's polygamy. Volume one is dedicated to history. Volume two is dedicated to what? Is it history as well?
Yeah, the first, okay. The histories had to be split into two.
Okay, and then the volume three is theology. These books are being released on February 26, 2013. That's in 6 days from the recording of this episode. You can buy these books at either Benchmark Books, at Coford Books, or on Amazon. And at least two of those outlets are offering sort of a pre-release sale. If you want to order these books early, you might get a discount. So very exciting books. I think I read some of the reviews, and I think Richard Bushman wrote a really nice review. I think Todd Compton wrote a review. So, you know, you're getting a lot of respect and praise for these books, right? Right, Brian?
Yeah, it's we had reviews from Richard and Todd Compton, also Larry Foster and Dan Bachman. And what's interesting, though, is that while they praised the books and Larry Foster said they're must-haves, several of these authors acknowledge that my position is not something that's agreed with by all scholars. So it'll be interesting to see what kind of pushback I get over the years.
Sure, sure. Yeah, I noticed that both Compton and Bushman wrote, I don't always agree with his conclusions, but he's a great scholar. And that's fine, right?
Yeah. No, yeah. That's great. Yeah.
So this interview is actually going to be part of a four-part series, I'll call it. As you know, the Open Stories Foundation sponsors both Mormon Stories and several other podcasts, including a podcast called A Thoughtful Faith. And Sarah Collette, who's one of the main interviewers on A Thoughtful Faith, has already done a two-part interview, which we'll just call a deep dive into Joseph Smith's polygamy. You can access that at athoughtfulfaith.org. This second part is going to be on Mormon Stories, and it's going to be specifically a response to Grant Palmer, which we'll talk about in a second. And then Brian and I hope to record two more episodes, one that we're going to call Top 12 Myths About Joseph Smith's Polygamy. And then the final one will be something along the lines of reconciling polygamy with faith. So for those who desire to, you know, maintain some type of a testimony in the LDS Church, you know, how Brian's able to do that and maybe some ways to look at polygamy to where it doesn't have to be incompatible with faith. So that's kind of what we have in store. But today we're going to be focusing specifically on something Brian felt really strongly about. In February of 2012, I interviewed Grant Palmer for the second time on Mormon Stories. And this time he wanted to announce his resignation from the church, but also he wanted to talk about some history that he had felt he had, you know, some history he'd performed. I don't know the right verb to use there, but he had done an analysis, a historical analysis of sexual allegations against Joseph Smith. And then he also wanted to talk about William and Jane Law. William Law having been one of Joseph's members of the First Presidency in Nauvoo prior to Joseph's assassination. And he wanted to give his perspective historically on these sexual allegations and on William and Jane Law. It was definitely a controversial podcast, and it caused a lot of people to feel some pretty strong things. And so, Brian, why don't we start with you just telling us why you felt so strongly about wanting to respond directly to Grant? Because normally we don't do responses sort of in a direct way. And I certainly have a lot of respect for Grant Palmer and don't want, you know, to feel like we're attacking him in any way. I know, Brian, that's not your style. I did invite Grant to be on this podcast. He didn't think it would be constructive to have sort of a back and forth kind of thing. I've given him an open invitation to come back on the podcast later. I just want to say all that up front. But Brian, why don't you tell us why you wanted to respond to this podcast?
Well, I felt like Grant spoke for nearly an hour and talked about five allegations against six women. And we'll review some of his own words here. But as somebody who studied the actual evidence behind these alleged allegations, I thought he was embellishing the evidence beyond what is really a good scholarship. And again, I don't want to be negative on Grant. He's a really nice guy, and he's always been kind to me. But in the interest of just getting good history out there to our listeners, I felt like we needed some more clarification.
Okay, so why don't we jump in? And it looks like in your PowerPoint presentation, which again is on youtube.com/MormonStories, or you'll be able to download this from MormonStories.org. It looks like you start with some actual time codes from the podcast that you wanted to sort of lay out some of his actual verbiage. Is that right?
Well, yeah. And again, I don't want to make him an offender for a word, you know, using Isaiah's words. But and let me just say at the outset, we all, when we're interviewed, make misstatements. And if he comes back and says, look, I really didn't mean that, I fully understand that, because I hope to have that same benefit should it occur during this interview.
Yeah.
But so that's not the point. But I want to draw a nice picture for the listener, especially if they haven't heard his interview, to let them know what I'm responding to, so we're kind of on the same page.
All right. Well, let's let it rip.
Okay, great. And thank you, John, for letting me participate. You do amazing interviews. I've listened to several of them, many of them actually, and I appreciate the opportunity to respond to Grant here and have these other podcasts. But to get the story out there of what we're talking about, you can see on the slide, but he makes three statements, and then in his article, and for those who aren't familiar with his article, you can go to just Google his name, and it's on Mormon Stories. It's on MormonThink.
Yep.
.com/grant6.htm.
We'll include a link on Mormon Stories to that article.
Okay, sorry.
No worries.
But I'll be talking about the article as well as what he said during the interview. But he says, and I'm going to quote all three of these. He says six allegations in a three-state period over a five-year period. He said Joseph Smith must have been mortified to be accused of sexually improper conduct by at least four women during a six-year period in three states. And then later he says, all I can say is that I would be mortified, and I'm sure any person would be, if they were accused over a six-year period of having unwanted sexual advances against four or five teenage girls in three different states. That is a mortifying thing. And then later he says, as a married man, Joseph Smith must have been mortified of being accused of improper sexual conduct with at least four young women during this six-year period. And then in his article, he said it is generally unknown that he was accused of illicit sexual conduct with six young women from 1829 to 1835.
Okay.
So this is kind of what we're talking about.
All right. And do you see, though, you're not trying to highlight inconsistency between those statements, are you?
No. And this is why I said I don't want to make him an offender for the word, because I think what he's talking about are five allegations against six women. There is the one statement where he says he was accused by at least four women. I am going to come back to that, but I'm guessing that was just a misstatement on his part. As you will see, there's certainly no evidence for even one of those. But we'll get into the evidence, and then the listener can kind of make their own decision.
Okay. All right. Let's do it.
All right. Regarding the first allegation and the first woman, and we go to you'll maybe want to put a link to my article from the Journal of Mormon History, 2009. You can download the whole issue for free since it's 3 years old. But I have an article there that comprises nearly 80 pages, and it deals with all of these allegations and these episodes, plus a number more that I deal with there. So somebody can get the details if they don't want to try to transcribe things I'm saying. You can certainly get the article for free and look it over. So
it's called Fanny Alger and Joseph Smith's Pre-Nauvoo Reputation.
Right.
All right.
And you can get that at the Utah State website, where they've got everything archived.
We'll link to it as well.
Super. Okay. Super. Well, if we go to the next slide, then what I've done is, here's what Grant says as an introduction regarding a woman named Eliza, and I think her name is Elizabeth, but we all call her Eliza Winters. At 18 minutes in, he says, when Joseph Smith was in Harmony, Pennsylvania in 1828-29, translating the Book of Mormon, some of Emma Smith's cousins and the Lewises, that's who her cousins were, the Lewises, they make this accusation that Joseph Smith had been familiar with 16-year-old Eliza Winters, who was a very good friend of Emma Smith's. And then some of the neighbors say a few things, and it is kind of neighborhood stuff. And so that sounds pretty bad. Sounds like Joseph did something. Everybody in the neighborhood knows about it. And so he's embarrassed. And golly, why would Joseph do this? This is not good. For those of us who are believers, that's how we might respond. Well, actually, when we get into the evidence, it appears that Grant has kind of embellished things just a little bit, because there is only one single sentence in the entire historical record that ties Joseph Smith to Eliza Winters. And if you look on the slide, it's that which is underlined in yellow. And here's what it says. Harris, and he's talking about Martin Harris, one of the three witnesses, said that he did not blame Smith for Smith's attempt to seduce Eliza Winters, etc. So there's a couple of problems. First off, this is not a firsthand accusation. Levi Lewis does not accuse Joseph Smith. Neither do any of Lewis's family or any of Emma Smith's cousins, so far as this evidence goes. And so I would invite Grant, if he had actual evidence, that these individuals were accusing him. And you may think that this is just hair splitting, but this is repeating an accusation that allegedly came from Martin Harris. And if we look at the paragraph, it comes from a book called Mormonism Unveiled. It's back on page 268, and it's a paragraph where the author, E.D. Howe, or it may have been Philastus Hurlbut, I'm not sure who Levi Lewis was talking to, but they just write down all these accusations from Levi Lewis regarding Joseph Smith and the Smith family. But what's interesting is if you read the very last sentence of that paragraph, it says, with regard to the plate, Smith said God had deceived him, which was the reason he, Smith, did not show them. Well, anybody who's looked at even an 1830 Book of Mormon knows that there is a testimony at the back of the book, that's where it was then, of eight witnesses who saw the plates, who said they did, and three witnesses who said they saw the plates and an angel. So you can see Levi Lewis is not really very close to what's going on with Joseph Smith. But when you find this blatantly false statement in the same paragraph, it doesn't really lend a lot of credibility to earlier sentences, including the one that he quotes here about Harris and this accusation with Eliza.
So it's saying that Smith – so what's your understanding again of what that sentence says about Smith, that the sentence is claiming that Smith said God deceived him, as in Joseph Smith?
Right. Levi Lewis is, I believe, talking about the golden plates. Sorry, I kind of ran through that quick, John.
No, it's okay.
And then he quotes Joseph Smith as saying that God had deceived him regarding the golden plates, which is why Joseph Smith never showed them to anybody. But again, that's just false.
So this book is claiming that Joseph Smith said that God deceived Joseph Smith.
Well, the book isn't so much as Levi Lewis is. This
right.
The only person we have saying anything about Joseph Smith being involved with Eliza Winters is also saying that Joseph Smith said that he didn't show the plates to anybody. See, it's a problem. It's just not credible.
Yeah. Okay, all right.
But then if we look at the actual sentence, he's quoting Martin Harris. And this is curious because Martin Harris in the early 1830s was a very devout, aggressive Mormon missionary. And we've got that documented quite well. So what we have to believe, if this is true, is that Martin Harris saw Joseph Smith try to seduce Eliza Winters, which in Book of Mormon, sexual immorality is ranked next to murder. And I know that's controversial, but Heber C. Kimball read it that way in 1857, Orson Pratt read it that way too. So you have this very serious sin, and Joseph is supposed to have tried to seduce Eliza, and then Martin Harris is supposed to just ignore that and go off and be a very devout Mormon missionary promoting Joseph as a prophet. It's just a little less plausible. And then the other problem is that Eliza Winters herself in 1833 was accused by Martin Harris of giving birth to a bastard child. Now, Eliza wasn't a woman to take things sitting down. She took Martin Harris to court for slander. And during the whole proceedings, and we have a number of notes about it, there's no mention of Joseph Smith trying to seduce her or in any way having done anything that was a problem for her. So she had an opportunity to disparage Joseph and didn't take it in 1833. But even more significant is that nearly 50 years later, Eliza was 70 years old. A newspaper man named Frederick Mather interviewed her and a bunch of other people from the Susquehanna County, Pennsylvania area. And he was specifically trying to get derogatory statements about Joseph Smith and his family from former acquaintances. And in that interview, Mather recorded Eliza Winters saying, "Joe Smith never made a convert in Susquehanna." So here you've got Mather looking for dirt. And Eliza says, yeah, he didn't get any converts here, but she doesn't mention anything about Joseph trying to seduce her, even though it was the perfect scenario, the perfect environment for her to have corroborated this earlier claim. And personally, I think Mather probably brought it up and that Eliza couldn't verify that, and that's why he didn't mention it. But again, that's speculation on my part.
And let me just be clear, who knows what really happened, right? So, you know, there's always a possibility that she didn't want to talk about it, or she was uncomfortable, or she even feared for her life or something like that. But that's not what we're trying to do here. What we're trying to do is what? Look at the evidence?
Well, if we laser in on the evidence, all we have is one single sentence that has some plausibility problems. But I appreciate you giving it some context. You know, what you said is absolutely right. Maybe there were other reasons, or maybe she was at 70 years old, forgetful. But since this is the very best evidence and the only evidence we have with Eliza Winters and Joseph Smith, you know, it just doesn't come across as really very strong. In fact, Richard Bushman said, considering how eager the Palmyra neighbors were to besmirch Joseph's character, their minimal mention of moral lapses suggests libertinism was not part of his New York reputation. Marvin Heal, the historian, also concurred. He said it is a fact that none of the earliest anti-Mormon writers, neither Dogberry nor E.D. Howe, who was the author of this book, charge Smith with sexual immorality. So I just am saying that we have one single sentence attaching Joseph and Eliza. But if you didn't know that from listening to Grant talk about Eliza, I mean, going back to what he said that it was a whole neighborhood thing and that it was Emma's cousins and the Lewises. I mean, you come away thinking there's all these testimonies and all this good contemporaneous evidence that are firsthand accounts, right. and yet there's none of that when you actually get into the evidence.
So is this the reference that he uses in his paper to talk about Eliza Winters?
Yeah, it's the only one that he uses. And to my knowledge, it's the only one in existence. But I would invite Grant or any of the listeners, if you have any other evidence tying Joseph to Eliza Winters, I'd love to see it because I haven't been able to find any.
Okay, got it. So for you, the claims regarding Eliza Winters are weak or, you know, feeble or just not credible.
Right. They're problematic at best.
Okay. Okay. Let's go to Miriam and Rhoda Stoll. Is that next?
Yeah, that is next. And here's at 19 minutes, here's what Grant said. He said, evidence comes from two of the 12 witnesses, which were called in the trial 30 June 1830. That is the court record on that one. That is Josiah Stoll's daughters, Miriam, and he couldn't remember Rhoda. They are 18 and 20 respectively. He says there had been rumors against Joseph and so forth. And so the prosecutor, I think based upon what happened to Eliza Winters in 1828-29, and I think the witnesses are being asked by the prosecutor, and I think it is a fishing expedition in this case because nothing really came of it. There is an accusation there by at least the prosecutor. So, I mean, he's kind of vacillating. Is this a fishing expedition? He calls it very plainly an accusation and an allegation. But there are some real problems with bringing this up at all. To give you a little bit of history, though, the hearing was called because Peter G. Bridgman, who was a nephew of Josiah Stoll, was worried that Joseph Smith was trying to dupe his uncle out of his money. The problem with Grant's report is there are no trial records. And I emailed Dan Vogel, who is, I think, unarguably the expert on documents from this period. And he said, no, we don't have any records from that particular court case. But if you listen to what Grant said, he said, that is the court record on that one. And again, I don't mean to make an offender for a word, but he says there's a court record and there isn't. And if there is, I would invite him to produce that record that shows that anybody accused Joseph Smith of anything that was immoral at that time. We have an account from Josiah Stoll Jr. He never joined the church, but he later was approached by a Mormon missionary, John Fulmer, to respond to, you know, what do you remember about Joseph Smith? And here is what Josiah Stoll Jr. said. He said, I have been intimately acquainted with Joseph Smith about 2 years. He then was about 20 years old or thereabout. I also went to school with him on Winter. He said he was a fine, likely young man and at the time did not profess religion. He was not a profane man, although I did once in a while hear him swear. He never gambled, to my knowledge. I do not believe he ever did. I well know he was no horse jockey, for he was no judge of horses. I sold him one. That is all I ever know that he dealt in the kind. I never knew him to get drunk. I believe he would now and then take a glass. He never pretended to play sleight of hand nor blackleg. So here you've got someone who was there. It's a late recollection. It's kind of entertaining. That's why I included it, John, to hear this guy talk about Joseph in the 1829 time period. But he didn't remember anything negative about Joseph or anything regarding his own sisters being in any way approached by Joseph for some immoral kind of behavior. But what's really problematic with Grant's presentation is that Grant does quote a later account, and it's Joseph Smith's account. And here's what Joseph Smith said about this. We don't have the actual court records, so we don't know what was there. But Joseph Smith recalled, and this was printed in the Times and Seasons, he said, the young women arrived, this is both Miriam and Rhoda, and were severally examined touching my character and conduct in general, but particularly as to my behavior towards them in public and private. Well, it's unfortunate because Grant stops quoting right there. And then he goes on and implies that this was to determine things about sexual behavior. In fact, in the written version at this point is where Grant interjects with brackets sexual behavior. The problem is that it's mid-sentence where Grant starts. If you quote the rest of the sentence, here's what it says. When they both bore such testimony in my favor as left my enemies without a pretext on their account. So what we have in this case is, and Grant does in his own defense call it a fishing expedition, but we have no record of anybody accusing him. We can assume or speculate that it happened, but there is no evidence to that effect. But what we do have as far as the evidence is no evidence. It's non-evidence, and then we have a later account from Joseph Smith, which is actually in his favor regarding this particular episode. But Grant has, through his discussion, turned non-evidence and favorable evidence to Joseph and turned it 180 degrees as an account that is negative to him. To me, that's just problematic.
Okay. All right. So that's down with Miriam and Rhoda Stoll for you as well.
Right. And again, I'm trying not to misrepresent what Grant said, but that's particularly kind of egregious or problematic to me.
And we'll invite our listeners if they want to tell us where we're wrong or where we got it wrong, or if anyone wants to produce evidence, we will want to share that as well.
Well, and let me add that Juanita Brooks, you know, a Mormon historian, excellent, made the comment, you never get it all. She was talking about historical sources, and I fully believe that. And so if somebody has additional evidences I've missed, which is entirely possible, I would appreciate it. By all means, please speak up and let's get the evidence out there. That's what I want.
We'll invite our listeners to post their comments to the MormonStories.org page for this podcast, where others can go and reference any follow-up responses.
Fantastic. That would be great.
All right. Let's go to Miranda Nancy Johnson.
Okay. And Miranda is actually the third woman. I'm sorry, the fourth woman in the third allegation.
Just is it Miranda or Miranda?
It's Miranda.
Okay.
And in fact, Grant calls her Nancy Miranda Johnson. It actually is Miranda Nancy Johnson. And the reason I know that is that she signed her affidavit in 1869, capital M, capital N. But Grant isn't the only one to get those names mixed up.
I think the slide says Miranda instead of Marinda.
Oh, did I? Well, see, didn't I tell you that?
But it's okay. It's okay. I'm just acknowledging it for the listeners.
Yeah.
But,
and for the listeners, see, I told you other people get it mixed up because it's it's Miranda. But sometimes people juxtapose Nancy and Miranda.
Okay.
Grant says here at 34 minutes is, there is a question about Joseph Smith making advances against their sister, Nancy Miranda Johnson. And the next thing we know is that in the middle of the night, at least four or five people appear, including Eli Johnson, and he is the uncle of Nancy Miranda. And, you know, and I may have heard him wrong. It should be Nancy Miranda. And they think that there are some sexual things going on there. And I don't know how, and I don't defend it, but they take Joseph Smith out in the night, and they have a Dr. Dennison there, and he is there for the purpose of castration of Joseph Smith. So that's how Grant kind of deals with this.
And this is a story that I've heard a lot, that a mob in 1832 felt like Joseph had taken advantage of somebody, and they pulled him out of his house with the attempt to castrate him, right?
Exactly.
And is that the same event when somebody tried to pour a vial of poison down his throat? Is that?
Yes. Okay. Yes. It was nitric acid and chipped his tooth. Somebody scraped, you know, the story. They scratched him saying that's the way the Holy Ghost falls on you. And then they tarred and feathered both Joseph and Sidney Rigdon.
Okay. So that's a story that's told a lot. Are you saying that you have a different perspective on that story?
I'm just saying let's identify the evidence that story is based upon and just see where it leads us.
All right.
Okay. What we find is that the account of the mobbing was first published in 1842 in the Times and Seasons. Now, nothing was said in that account about Joseph and Miranda being involved with each other, and nothing was said in that account about a doctor being there to castrate Joseph Smith.
That would probably have a point of view, the Times and Seasons, because it's a church publication. If there were some impropriety, they probably wouldn't want to be printing that. Is that a fair statement?
Oh, absolutely. No, you wouldn't expect those things to be in there. But as we're trying to trace those two details, when were they first mentioned? I mean, that's the question I'm trying to answer here. So I'm just saying they weren't in that account, which is something we would not expect.
Okay.
Good point.
Okay.
Then in 1858, Luke Johnson. Now, Luke is Miranda's brother, and he was one of the first Quorum of the 12 apostles. But he is excommunicated, comes back to the church, goes to Utah, becomes a bishop. But in 1858, and he's obviously biased, but he recounts the mobbing, even though he wasn't there, but he knew what has happened because it was in his father's home. But he is the one who first mentions that there was a doctor there who was going to castrate the prophet. So the first time that we find anybody talking about that particular detail is 1858. he doesn't mention anything about Marinda and Joseph. Being involved with each other, Marinda is not part of the discussion. And just so that you know, if you go to Grant's written version, he's got the reference at the bottom, and it's not correct. This account was published both in the Millennial Star and in the Deseret News, and you have to go to the it was a serial, and you have to go to the previous one to get this particular account, just for those who may want to look it up. But the real problem with Grant's view is that nobody mentioned any involvement between Joseph and Marinda until 1884. And the first person that I've been able to find, and again, if somebody has other evidence, please bring it forth. Let's hear it. Let's deal with it. But it seems to be Clark Braden in 1884 was debating E.L. Kelly. He was a future presiding bishop of the RLDS Church. Clark Braden was a Church of Christ Disciples minister. And the guy was against any church, every church but his own. And he was a very aggressive debater. He was willing to debate anyone. And other churches, not just the RLDS, didn't like to debate this guy because he was so free and easy with his facts. In other words, he'd come out in a debate and throw out all these ideas and claims, most of which just weren't true. And the poor opponent, whatever church they were belonging to, would be back reeling because he would have to try to just set up what was true and what was not true, according to Clark Braden. So people didn't like to debate this guy. But in the 19th debate, and you've got it there in the slide, and this went over the course of several days in Kirtland. In the 19th debate, he comes out with this rapid fire list of allegations of sexual impropriety against Joseph Smith, and some of them are pretty amazing. But he is the first person to mention anything about Joseph being involved with Marinda. And here's what he said. In March of 1832, Joseph Smith was stopping at Mr. Johnson's in Hiram, Ohio. Actually, he was living there for a year and was mobbed. The mob was led by Eli Johnson, who blamed Smith with being too intimate with his sister Marinda. Now, we know this is a secondhand account because Clark Braden was born in 1831. We don't know who his source was. He didn't give a source, and neither have I been able to find anybody else associating Joseph Smith and Marinda except for this one account. And what's interesting, John, is that between 1832, when this happened, and 1884, when Clark Braden first mentioned it, we find several anti-Mormons talking about the mobbing. Not a single person mentions it being because Joseph was involved with Marinda. They all attribute it to the law of consecration that was then being implemented and the fear from Eli Johnson and others that Joseph Smith and Sidney Rigdon were trying to get their property. Also on this account, we have in 1877, Marinda is giving her own history. And she says at this point, I feel like bearing my testimony that during the whole year that Joseph was an inmate of my father's house, I never saw aught in his daily life or conversation to make me doubt his divine mission. So here we have, now she was a devout member. She had every reason to want to remember positive things about Joseph, but she gives us this testimony that contradicts Clark Braden flat out. And another problem is that we have Grant presenting at 37 minutes. He said the person reporting this information is Luke Johnson. It is the brother of Nancy Marinda Johnson. No, as I mentioned, Luke Johnson doesn't mention anything about Joseph and Marinda. So you come away after hearing Grant thinking that there's all this evidence about Joseph and Marinda when really you have a single secondhand sentence in an 1884 debate that was later published supporting this connection.
Right. Okay. That appears problematic from what evidence you do provide. You know, this reminds me of You know the story of Sidney Rigdon and Brigham Young both giving up to give their speeches in front of the city of Nauvoo to try and claim succession. And, you know, the famed story about whether or not Joseph's countenance was transfigured or Brigham's countenance was transfigured during that talk, right?
And, yeah.
And skeptics claim there was no contemporary evidence supporting that interpretation. And that instead it was a story told 10 or 20 years later that then sort of caught on. But I guess it's fair to say that if critics are going to discount a story like that based on lack of contemporary evidence, they would probably, in all fairness, need to look at this with the same level of suspicion. Is that fair to say?
Well, Yeah, in fact, in our next interview, I want to kind of touch on what kind of guides our beliefs with respect to Joseph Smith and plural marriage, and we'll deal with some observations. But you know, we would like to be constant with our skepticism, and I think an excellent analogy, I think, John.
Okay, all right. Well, that's really interesting because that's, I would say that's in the top 10 or 20 most problematic historical events that critics of the church are likely to quote. And it sounds like maybe people have been taking a story at face value that might not deserve that based on the evidence.
Again, I think if we get back to the evidence, we may not agree, but everybody wins. And when it comes to Joseph Smith and polygamy, that's my plea.
Okay.
I don't expect you to agree with me, but let's just be quoting evidence when we disagree.
Okay. All right. Who's next?
Okay. Now we're talking about the fourth woman, and this is the third allegation, and it's Miss Hill. And at 41 minutes, Grant said this. He said, a servant girl living in Joseph's house. All we know her by is Miss Hill, and that improper procedures were made. And that comes from reported by Benjamin F. Winchester. Now, right at the outset, this is problematic because there is no Benjamin F. Winchester. And again, I don't want to get nitpicky. There's a Benjamin Winchester and there's a Benjamin F. Johnson. But the problem compounds because neither one of them mentioned Miss Hill in any context that I've been able to discover. So I would invite Grant or any other listener to produce anybody besides William McClellan. He's the only person to talk about a Miss Hill in any correspondence, in any historical document that I am aware of. But if somebody has other evidence, then let's deal with it. So anyway, we've got a misstatement here on the part of Grant regarding who said it. Now, if you are able to go to the slide for Miss Hill, I have to read part of a letter. And this letter is from William McClellan. William McClellan was one of the original apostles who apostatized from the church. He was a very gifted guy, very smart, very bright. But he had a love-hate relationship with Joseph Smith after the martyrdom, as near as I can tell. But he wrote a letter to Joseph Smith III. And in 1872, so we're out quite a ways, 37 years after this described Miss Hill event. And he's writing to Joseph Smith III to convince Joseph Smith III that his father, Joseph Smith the prophet, was in fact practicing plural marriage. And here's an excerpt from the letter. It's actually a very long letter. It's been reproduced a number of times, a number of places. But here's what he wrote. He said, now Joseph Smith III, I will relate to you some history and refer you to your own dear mother, Emma, for the truth. You will probably remember that I visited your mother and family in 1847 and held a lengthy conversation with her, retired in the mansion house in Nauvoo. I did not ask her to tell, but I told some stories I had heard, and she told me whether I was properly informed. Dr. Frederick E. Williams practiced with me in Clay County, Missouri, during the latter part of 1838. And he, Frederick G. Williams, told me that at your birth, that's November of 1832, your father committed an act with a Miss Hill, a hired girl. Emma saw him and spoke to him. He desisted, but Mrs. Smith refused to be satisfied. He called in Dr. Williams, Oliver Cowdery, and Sidney Rigdon to reconcile Emma. But she told him just as circumstances took place, he found he was caught, he confessed humbly and begged forgiveness. Emma and all forgave him. She told me this story was true. Then he says this, again, I told her I heard that one night she missed Joseph and Fanny Alger. She went to the barn and saw him and Fanny in the barn together alone. She looked through a crack and saw the transaction. She told me the story, too, was verily true. So this is the only sentence in any historical document that I'm aware of that ties Joseph Smith to a Miss Hill. It's obviously secondhand because he's apparently quoting M.S. Smith on this particular issue. Now, the question comes up, is he talking about first an episode between Joseph and Miss Hill? And then when he says again, he's then switching to a second event with Joseph and Fanny Alger, or is he just getting confused with a Fanny Hill and a Fanny Alger and simply repeating the previous allegation for emphasis purpose. Well, I believe Linda Keen Newell and Val Tippetts Avery, who wrote, perhaps in his old age, William McClellan confused the hired girl Fanny Alger with Fanny Hill of John Cleland's 1749 lewd novel and came up with the hired girl, Miss Hill. And here's some of the reasons why I believe that this is just talking about Fanny Alger. And of course, we're going to talk about her in just a minute. But the first part of the paragraph specifies that Emma saw an interaction between Joseph and a hired girl identified as Miss Hill. And then in the second half of the same paragraph, McClellan states that Emma saw him and Fanny in a barn together. So if there were two separate encounters, Emma apparently witnessed both of them. McClellan related that when Emma learned of the relationship, she refused to be satisfied, requiring, you know, immense efforts from Joseph to assuage her distress. And then, so it's a little strange that after this occurred, that he would go out and do the exact same thing and be caught in the exact same place with a second woman. You know, he said he had to get Oliver Cowdery and Sidney Rigdon and Frederick G. Williams to take care of the first issue with Miss Hill. But if they were thinking that this is two accounts that he's relating, then sometime thereafter, Joseph goes right out and does it again. Now, a lot of people think, well, you know, Joseph had a lot of libido, so that's easy for me to believe. But put in context, I think it's somewhat less likely in light of how hard it was. But in an interview 3 years later, 1875, McClellan is approached by J.H. Beadle. He is the author of Mysteries and Crimes of Mormonism. You know, there were a lot of these being published, and that was in 1870. He wrote this, Beadle did. But he interviews McClellan. He goes back to Missouri and interviews him. And then he says this, McClellan also informed me of the spot where the first well-authenticated case of polygamy took place, in which Joseph Smith was sealed to a hired girl, like Miss Hill, in the 1872 letter. The sealing took place in a barn on a haymow, like Fanny Alger in this 1872 letter, and was witnessed by Mrs. Smith through a crack in the door. So see, what we have in 1875 is William McClellan giving one story with characteristics of both Miss Hill and Fanny Alger. And I would believe that if McClellan had known of two women and two indiscretions, he would have been very happy to share that information with Beadle. I just think that we have – Miss Hill is a cipher. Nobody can find any reference. Grant gives her credibility by saying that she was a hired girl in the Smith home. And I would invite Grant or anybody listening to provide some documentation of a Miss Hill in the Smith home or a Miss Hill in the Kirtland area during the 1832 to 1836 period in any kind of a capacity. We can't find this woman, and lots of people have looked very hard. So that's the thing, and it's a single sentence. It's a secondhand source, and to my mind, it's in a confusing letter, not the best evidence of some impropriety of Joseph Smith.
And is it saying here that Frederick G. Williams told McClellan?
Right, that's what he quotes anyway, and that's why he brings it up to Emma when in the 1847 interview.
Okay, so it's, tell me if I'm wrong here, it's McClellan writing to Joseph Smith III, saying that he heard from Frederick G. Williams that Joseph Smith committed an act with a Miss Hill.
Yes, but that was verified. Oh, I see what you're saying. Whatever he was talking about was verified by Emma Smith. So either he's quoting Frederick G. Williams and or Emma regarding Miss Hill, unless he really meant Fanny Alger.
Okay. Yeah, and so we can't find any existence of a Miss Hill. You would think that if Emma had learned about Miss Hill and a Fanny Alger so early on, that we would have heard of that at some way, or that Oliver Cowdery, who knew about Fanny Alger, might have also heard about this Miss Hill. That somehow it would have been, you know, known. Is that fair to? You know, to suspect?
Well, it'd be pretty sensational gossip for somebody to have remembered. And yet the only reference that I have found is that single sentence about Miss Hill. But again, when you listen to Grant talk about Miss Hill, you get the impression that there's a lot of pretty good evidence that this actually occurred. You don't realize this is a confusing letter about a woman that we can't identify in any other situation that anyway, seems to be confused with Fanny Alger.
And again, I want to make sure that I understand this. Am I reading this to say that it's Frederick Williams, that McClellan is claiming that he heard this from Frederick Williams? Is that true?
Well, the letter says that Williams told him about this. So then in 1847, he repeats it to Emma, and Emma verily told me it was true, I think is the language that he used in the letter.
Okay, but he's claiming that he heard it from Williams.
Originally, yeah. Yeah, that's a good point, actually. I hadn't thought about that distinction. But
yeah, so it's allegedly, you know, Williams telling McClellan, and then McClellan is reporting this how many years later?
This is 1872, the letter.
Yeah, so that's decades later, when he's much older. And there's good reason to believe, based on this quote, that he really is talking about Fanny Alger versus someone named Hill.
Well, again, I'm just presenting the evidence, John, and people can believe what they want to believe. But what I think is important that we didn't get from Grant's interview is just how tenuous the basic, you know, core evidence is for all of the discussion about Miss Hill that he provided.
Yeah. Okay. And again, it's difficult to know whatever really happened in history, but the little that I know about the craft of history is that it's messy and that people do try and assassinate other people's character, especially during this time period. And if you want to be fair, you know, you can't take everything said, every statement made at face value.
Well, and that goes both ways for the apologist and the antagonist on this, but when you've got, and in fact, if you can go to the next slide, because to this point, we've talked about four of the five allegations right. that Grant presents that involve five of the six women. And if you look at the evidence, I mean, he talks for over 40 minutes about these four allegations. And if you look at what evidence is supporting them, you have a single secondhand statement regarding Eliza Winters. That is dubious, I think, at best. There's no evidence for Miriam. It's just conjecture and Rhoda Stoll. If you look at Miranda Nancy Johnson, it's a very late secondhand claim from Clark Braden, who you wouldn't really list as being that credible just because of the way he attacked every religion. And then the last one is a secondhand account in a very confusing letter from William McClellan. Now, McClellan is credible, but the letter and the way it's presented, it leaves you really wondering, okay, is he talking about Fanny Alger and thinking of her as Fanny Hill? Or is there really this mystery woman that nobody's ever been able to find anything else about? Is that the second woman that Joseph was involved with? So I'm just saying for 40 minutes, we hear some pretty nasty stuff about Joseph from Grant Palmer. But the evidence may not necessarily justify that level of condemnation that seems to be presented in those discussions about these individual women.
Okay, got it. So you in the next slide you talk about what Grant said about having one source. Why don't we talk about that?
Well, I kind of needed to throw this in because, you know, at 27 minutes, Grant says, if I only have one source on something, I generally do not use it. And if one of them is an unsavory source, I try to use that just as a backup. And he also said, you know, I try not to use E.D. Howe's book, Mormonism Unveiled, or he says he tries to be real careful. And so when you get that preliminary and then he starts talking about all of these allegations against Joseph, you're assuming that that Grant has more than one source just because he's prefaced things by saying if he only has one, he wouldn't be presenting what he's presenting. And so the poor listener is thinking, wow, there's all this evidence against Joseph with Eliza and with Miranda. Marinda and with, you know, Miss Hill and these Stoll sisters, when in fact, when you get down to it, unless I've missed something, and maybe Grant will come back with this, you know, all this extra evidence, but, you know, I don't think that it exists. But it just is kind of a little bit unfair to the poor listener who doesn't realize that each of these allegations is based on either no evidence or one single somewhat problematic source.
Okay, got it. So what you've got a few more slides here, beginning with one about Fanny Alger. How does Fanny Alger tie into all this?
Well, the fifth allegation that Grant presents, and he presents more than one source for this, to his credit, but it's Fanny Alger. And I spend several chapters in my book on this, and the article also has some extended discussion about Fanny. And what I've discovered, and this was with the help of Don Bradley, who I hired to help find all of the documents from any source, whether they were anti-Mormon or apologetic and everything in between, dealing with Joseph Smith and polygamy. What we found was 19 different references from individuals who were either involved directly or knew somebody who were involved. And they talk about Joseph Smith and Fanny Alger, and that's the chart there. And it's in, I have all of the accounts in Appendix D in my second volume of my books. But the reason that this is important is if you go to the next slide, and this slide is available on my website, and you can go to the website and click on these individual persons and observations, and you can get the actual evidence. So it's all there on the website. But the evidence comes in three different with respect to Joseph Smith and Fanny Alger, the evidence supports, you know, three different aspects. One, several of them are just ambiguous, but several of the statements are supporting adultery, that Joseph Smith and Fanny Alger committed adultery. And it's very plain that Oliver Cowdery, who said that it was a dirty, nasty, filthy affair, and actually the word that we trace back to Oliver is not affair, it's scrape.
Yeah.
Well, and I talk about that in my book. Don Bradley's the one who figured that out, and Chris Smith, actually. But there's a statement by Fanny Brewer. Emma's actions show very plainly she didn't think it was a legitimate plural marriage. She threw Fanny right out of the house at night, according to one of the accounts. And of course, Clark Braden weighed in with his view of it. And then there's a person that we've yet to identify, Historicus, who wrote in 1881, calling it free loveism. So we've got this evidence that it was adultery. But there's also some pretty significant evidence that it was a plural marriage, or at least that a marriage ceremony was performed. Now, Oliver may have known this and just says, baloney, I don't believe it's legitimate. But I think most of us are familiar with Todd Compton's book, and Todd was the first to report the Mosiah Hancock statement that Mosiah related how Levi had performed a marriage ceremony with Joseph Smith, telling him what to say and giving him priesthood authority to perform it. It would have been a time only. It wasn't a sealing, and nobody said it was a sealing, but it would have been a priesthood marriage just like he had performed for other monogamous couples before and after. But there is a new evidence that's been found. Again, this is by Don Bradley, and if you go to the next slide here, this is real quick. Oh, go ahead.
It's fair to say that Mosiah Hancock reference is like way, I mean, it's like more than 50 years after the event, probably. What, 1896? Is that what's on the slide?
Yeah, and in fact, maybe I should go over this for the people who don't have the slide in front of them. There's quite a number of observations about that this, in fact, was a marriage ceremony, that there was one performed. Chauncey Webb is who Fanny went to live with for a few weeks after Emma Smith threw Fanny out of the house. And they later recalled that it was a sealing, or a marriage was performed. And then his wife, Elijah Jane Churchill Webb, also quoted it as being a sealing or a marriage. And then their daughter, Anna Eliza Webb Young, who wrote an anti-Mormon book called Wife 19, but she also referred to it as being a marriage. Their actions are also consistent with that because they followed the saints to Nauvoo and even later to Utah. But interestingly enough, both Chauncey and Eliza Jane and Anne Eliza all apostatized. But they didn't see anything in what was happening in Kirtland as a reason to apostatize at that time. In addition, Fanny Alger's family followed the church clear into Utah, and it wasn't her brother, John Alger, apostatized in 1891 because he couldn't accept the 1890 manifesto. But he didn't see anything in what was going on with his sister and Joseph as a reason to apostatize. Then we have statements from John Hawley and Benjamin F. Johnson verifying that it, in fact, was a plural marriage. So, and let me just say before we look at the Eliza R. Snow account, that what Grant Palmer has done as he discusses Fanny Alger is simply discuss the evidence supporting adultery and ignore the evidence supporting plural marriage. And then getting back to your actual comment, John, yes, the Mosiah Hancock statement is far from the most credible. Further on in the particular document where Mosiah is writing, there's some just really crazy stuff that he writes. So it isn't as solid a support as you would like, but I believe that there's some new evidence that is even more significant, and that's what I wanted to talk about. So did that address your concern?
Yeah, I'm just saying that I guess what I hear you saying as I'm trying to understand it is just that, you know, we don't know for sure what happened, whether a marriage ceremony happened or not, but if we're going to say that it was, if Grant Palmer, for example, is going to say that it was just adultery, and or with some of these other women, he's going to pull up references that are 50, 60, 70 years after to support something that happened much previously, even from questionable sources, to be fair and consistent, it should also be noted that lots and lots of people wrote down that they understood Joseph to have married Fanny Alger before any sexual impropriety happened. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yes. And to be honest with you, that's what I'm trying to do in my books and on my website, is to provide both sides of this issue. I don't want to have people accuse me of doing that very thing. And if I've done it, I would welcome your readers to write in and say, you're not being fair with the evidence, Hales. You need to talk about this evidence that you didn't talk about. Because in my books, I start the chapters with the alternate perspective from what I think is the most accurate. And I list all of the evidence there. Richard Bushman reviewed some early chapters, and he commented, Brian, this is going to make it more, stronger than it would have otherwise been. And of course, I'm sure I stumbled, and there'll be lapses. Nothing's perfect. But I want people to know that I'm not afraid of the evidence that supports the position opposite of that which I believe to be the most accurate.
Okay, got it. Okay, keep going.
Okay, well, this is kind of fun. Going back to this Eliza R. Snow slide, there's a guy named Andrew Jensen, and he became an assistant church historian in 1891. But in 1887, he was an independent historian just like me, except I'm sure he's a lot better. He went around to Joseph Smith's plural wives who were still living and was trying to get a list of all of Joseph Smith's plural wives for an article that he was writing in the Historical Record. The Historical Record, he had authored it, and he was writing it in Danish, if I remember correctly, volumes 1 through 4. And then in volumes 5 through 10, he writes in English. And those are books you can buy. They're collector's items, but they're out there. And in fact, you can download them as PDFs now, but I spent a lot of money for my copy. But anyway, he writes this article on Joseph Smith's plural marriages, and it's an incredible treasure trove of information. But what we haven't had, and what Todd Compton didn't have, and Michael Quinn and Michael Marquardt and these other scholars who've written on polygamy, they didn't have access to his notes. And his notes are equally another treasure trove of information and help clarify some question marks that we didn't know. And one of them has to do, how did he come up with his list of 26 wives? And what we find in document one is that he went and interviewed Melissa Lott, and it's Don Bradley who did all of the detective work on this. But he figured out that he went down to Lehi and met with Melissa Lott, one of Joseph's plural wives, and this is in early 1887. And he gets from her, or he writes down in his own hand, 13 different names. And then sometime thereafter, he meets with Eliza R. Snow, and apparently he took the same piece of paper that he'd been writing on while he was talking to Melissa Lott, and he hands it to Eliza R. Snow. And Eliza writes 13 more names, and one of those names is Fanny Alger. But what's also important is that he starts a biographical sheet on Fanny Alger, and in that biographical sheet, he records that Eliza R. Snow was well acquainted with Fanny Alger, and that Eliza was there when Emma Smith made such a fuss about Fanny Alger. So we don't know when this relationship/marriage began. Todd Compton is still affirming 1832-33. I think that's way too early, but there is evidence supporting that. I think it was later 1835, maybe even 36. But what we can say is that it ended that the big explosion and the problems occurred in the spring of 1836, because that's the only time that Eliza was there living in the Smith's home, or at least that's when she went to live there. So we don't know when it started, but we should be able to agree that it ended sometime after the dedication of the Kirtland Temple, probably just weeks later. And Don Bradley's written a very nice article on that in The Persistence of Polygamy. But what is important is that Eliza wrote down Fanny Alger's name. And I believe if it had been adultery, I believe Eliza would have known it, and she wouldn't have included this name because she didn't need to cover anything up. She was just writing the plural wives and put Fanny's name down there because she knew what was going on. She talked to Fanny, and she knew that a marriage ceremony had been performed. So I think this is one more fairly important evidence supporting the interpretation that a marriage ceremony was performed between Joseph and Fanny.
Now, is it, what if someone were to say, well, you know, Joseph just later told Eliza that he had married Fanny, you know, to cover his tracks and to try and retroactively make what was, adultery more legitimate by retroactively referring to it as the first of his plural marriages. I mean, that's possible, right?
No, I think it's a very, very good observation. And in fact, I've had people ask that before. And what I would say to that is if we believe what Andrew Jensen wrote, that Eliza was well acquainted with Fanny, I think that makes it a little less likely that she would have been well acquainted with Fanny, been there for the blow up, and never asked the question, well, was it a marriage or was it adultery? And if it was adultery, would we expect Eliza to hang on? I mean, Eliza was a discerning lady, and in my view, would not have hung on to a prophet, Joseph Smith, who had been committing adultery back in Kirtland. I think that's less likely. But again, it's not a bad interpretation, and I welcome, you know, alternate views.
Yeah, so if I guess I'm – again, I'm not as familiar with this as you, but if it's true that Joseph had just committed adultery with Fanny, would it make any sense that Fanny's family would have followed, you know, the saints all the way out to Utah and remained active, faithful members? You would think that Fanny would have told her parents whether or not a marriage had occurred, and that somehow it would have been revealed to have been fraudulent, and that Eliza R. Snow probably would have asked these questions as well. Is that a fair consideration of what might have happened?
Well, I certainly see it that way. You know, when I read Fawn Brody's version, and I could add several other authors, I won't mention them by name, but when you read about Joseph Smith's alleged behavior, and then read about how Brigham and John Taylor and Eliza and Zina reacted to this alleged hypocrisy, which is the Fawn Brody version, they really are describing them as comic book characters. They aren't behaving like you and I are. And this is what I hope people will get out of my books, because they will hear the stories of the Nauvoo polygamists themselves. And they'll discover, I hope and I think, that these Nauvoo polygamists were just as skeptical, if not just as cynical, as you and I are about this polygamy. Yeah, oh, right, Joseph, you're just wanting sex. But that isn't it. They were convinced that this came from God. And to hear their stories just completely, I think, contradicts the Fawn Brody caricatures that she describes when it comes to polygamy in her book, No Man Knows My History.
Okay. All right. So it looks like the next slide is kind of a summary again.
Yeah, well, I'm just going back to you know, Grant really sold these five allegations. I'm sorry, five allegations against six women as being embarrassing. And you know, you have a disclaimer to people before they listen to Grant's discussion about these things. To, you know, basically, if you got a weak testimony, don't listen. And I think that was nice, John. That's not a criticism. But when you look at what evidence was actually there, and that these things are kind of somewhat dramatically described about being mortified, well, you know, would you really be mortified mortified to have Levi Lewis's account out there? Would you be mortified to have Clark Braden's, accusation out there? And what about this confusing letter? And how about the allegations of adultery as Fanny when you're ignoring the evidence of a plural marriage? See, nothing that's there would make me the least bit mortified. And Joseph was a religious figure. Every other preacher, every other minister saw him as a competitor. They felt that they needed to let their flocks know that Joseph was an imposter. So they were very willing, like Clark Braden, to kind of, stretch the truth or, falsify things, because the ends would justify the means. You got to show this Joseph Smith is really a bad guy. And if it's sexual immorality, well, let's throw that in. But what's interesting is you got to ask, and if you go to the very last slide, you just say, if this is the best evidence that Grant Palmer can find, and Grant's not alone. I mean, if you try to find anything there, and if you read my article, you'll find there's just not a lot of evidence that's the least bit credible that Joseph was a libertine or at least had that reputation in the 1830s. And if this is the best evidence that anybody can find of sexual improper conduct, well, just how likely is it that that behavior actually occurred? If this is the best evidence anybody can come up with, it just, it may be a valid question for some.
Okay. So just to try and represent a skeptic's point of view, we're never going to be able to know, who had sex with who and who's really telling the truth or not. All we have is a historical record that I will agree, at least I haven't always been as conscientious as relying on primary sources as I should. And I'm sure that there are many people in these debates who also have not been as conscientious. But the angle that I often like to take, I don't know if I want to call it Occam's razor, just this notion of what's plausible, what mosaic can we paint from the evidence that we have? And a skeptic is going to say, where there's smoke, there's fire, right? They're going to say, look, all you have to do is go to Nauvoo and see that Joseph was, and we're going to talk about this in the subsequent episodes, but what they're going to say is he wasn't telling Emma about all his marriages. He some feel he was pressuring these women, using his power over them to pressure them to be his wives. He was having sex with lots and lots and lots of women in the 1840s. So, these things that happened previously were just kind of the precursors. And, because he was a man of power and status, maybe he was able to suppress some. Maybe he was able to pressure people or buy people off. But if a skeptic would look at the Nauvoo time period and say he was clearly going crazy sexually with lots of women, then it would make perfect sense that prior there would be evidence, even if second or third hand, that he was sometimes getting caught, let's say, with his hand in the cookie jar, so to speak. So, what would you say to someone who would just kind of want to believe Grant and even these second or third hand allegations, just because where there's smoke, there's fire?
Great question. The way I would respond is, first off, we'll talk about this more, but you portray Joseph as getting all this sexual relations. We're going to have to talk about the evidence for that in the next one, because I don't see that. But
okay,
that'll
be a teaser. That'll be a teaser for the next episode. But
Keep going. There you go. The evidence for sexuality just is he did consummate 12 of the marriages. But the evidence that he was having a lot of sex, like some people have been portraying, I just don't find it there. And there's some observations that are really important. But what was your? Oh, it was Occam's razor. I'm working at a very big disadvantage, because I would argue there's only two explanations to why Joseph established plural marriage. One is that God commanded him to do it. The second one is libido. Really, that's it. I mean, we could come up with, he was trying a social experiment or something, but that's just not going to fly. The problem is that I sit here as a believer and I say God commanded it, But the only people who can believe that God commanded Joseph Smith to practice polygamy are the people who believe Joseph Smith, or that God was talking to Joseph Smith in the first place.
Right. Yep, that is fair. That's fair.
See, so when they hear about novel polygamy and they hear me say what I say and they say, oh, Brian's just an apologist and we know it was libido. And so they look back in the 1830s and they say, well, you know, it must have been libido back then. So there's just absolutely a disconnect there. There's no way for them. And I understand that this, again, is not a criticism of the people who don't believe Joseph was a prophet. For them to conclude it was libido driven, well, what else are they going to think? I mean, that's just human nature. And so it becomes a little problematic. But the issue of Occam's razor, which is, as I understand it, is the fewest number of assumptions, is probably going to lead you to the true interpretation. Is that how you understand it?
Yeah, that's probably more eloquent than I would have been able to describe it. Yeah.
Well, and you can assume, well, Joseph wanted sex, therefore he brings in polygamy and he brings in polyandry because he wants sex. And that's very simple. There's just one assumption there. And it sounds like it's going to be the best argument. In fact, there are entire books on Nauvoo polygamy that use that as the premise. But the problem with that is it doesn't describe what the Nauvoo polygamists themselves were experiencing. In other words, they would not have accepted that for one second. The 114 polygamists, besides Joseph Smith, these are men and women who had entered into polygamous relationships at the time of the martyrdom. If any of them had thought for one second that Joseph just wanted sex, they would have dumped him. They would have jumped ship. They might have rebelled against him. So see, there's a whole other story, and that requires us to introduce God, his teachings, his theology, all of this accompanies it. And then you've got to also remember that these men and women are watching Joseph very carefully. They're just as skeptical as you and I are. And so we can't make this assumption that sex was driving the process, because that is an artificial reconstruction. We have to include the reactions of the people who are watching him. We have to include his teachings to them. And then when we get that put together, we have a more accurate historical reconstruction. And then we have to look at how many assumptions are going to get us to a proper interpretation.
Okay, Brian. So before we end, was there one other thing you wanted to say about Fanny?
Well, yeah, out of respect for Grant, he throws out a challenge as he's talking about Fanny Alger. And I just wanted to respond to what he had challenged us regarding. He said, one Mormon scholar has claimed that Fanny Alger was Joseph's first polygamous wife. He's talking about Todd Compton in his book, In Sacred Loneliness. However, Grant says, to make the case compelling, the following observations need to be addressed. And he lists four. So I'm going to mention those and then respond to them. First, there is no marriage license or record of the ordinance. And I have to tell you, there is no marriage license for any of the polygamous marriages, the one in Kirtland or any of them in Nauvoo. These marriages were bigamous marriages at best, and they would have been against the law. That's why they are not recorded in any kind of an official document. Likewise, we have found no official church record either. These things were so secret that the only thing we find is that, with the exception of Joseph Celine de Sarah Ann Whitney, which was dictated as a revelation, there's just a few little references here and there in some coded language, and then there's nothing. So for Grant to demand that there be a marriage license or a record is just totally inconsistent with even later Nauvoo polygamy.
That makes sense.
And then the second one, he says, there is no revelation authorizing polygamous marriages until 1840. I'm not sure what Grant means by this, because the revelation wasn't written until 1843. Right. But you don't need a revelation to practice plural marriage. There was no revelation authorizing baptism, but they were baptizing before that. So this, to me, is just kind of a red herring. Why he would require a written revelation to do this is unclear to me.
Well, I mean, I think the average member of the church, who probably doesn't know about the details of the history, would hope that Joseph received a revelation before he started practicing polygamy. That's fair, right?
Yeah, and that is fair. And if that's what he's coming from, I understand. But Joseph Smith taught as early as 1831 that plural marriage was a correct principle, and authority was restored to do it. I don't know why we have to have something written down.
Maybe when you say authority, which authority do you mean?
Well, he apparently was just using regular priesthood authority, like he had used to marry Lydia Braithwaite and Newell Knight in Kirtland. That was priesthood authority, not from the state. and it married them in a monogamous marriage. But apparently he could use that as well to make a plural marriage. We don't know those details, but people often ask, well, he didn't have the sealing authority, so how could it have been a marriage? Well, he was performing marriages, and the priesthood authority would have allowed a polygamous marriage if God had commanded it or allowed for it. So, and then later in 1836, in April, he gets the visitation from Elijah and gets the sealing authority that he sits on for 5 years, doesn't use until 1841.
Okay, and again, what year was that, the Elijah?
That's April 3rd, 1836, in the Kirtland Temple.
That would have been after his experience with Fanny, right?
I believe so. I mean, you might make a case that Fanny Alger marriage was after that. I don't think so.
And so how could he be legitimately marrying Fanny without having received the keys to sealing?
Well, it wasn't a sealing. This is a very good question. It comes up quite often. Nobody has said it was a sealing. I'm unaware of any church leader or anybody who says this was a sealing. And Joseph had priesthood authority to marry, at least in his mind, to marry monogamous couples during this period. And so the conclusion I've drawn, again, we've got no documentation, and those that are really skeptical will say, well, I don't believe it could be used for that. But clearly, if it could, I believe it's clear that if he could perform the marriage using priesthood authority of, say, Newell Knight and Lydia Braithwaite in Kirtland, that same authority would have allowed him to be married to Fanny Alger. It wouldn't have been an eternal marriage. It's something they would have needed to perform again down the road, but if it was going to be lasting for eternity. But that would have been the authority that was available to them then.
So are you guessing that in his mind it was – The marriage to Fanny was a time only, not a time in eternity marriage?
Well, the timeline would have only allowed for that. See, one thing I haven't mentioned is that we have 22 accounts talking about an angel. Most of them mention a sword commanding Joseph Smith to practice plural marriage. One of those who related this is Mary Elizabeth Rollins Leitner, and she said there were three visits from the angel, and the first one was in 1834. And if she's right, what I believe is the angel came and said, Joseph, we want this restored now. And Joseph's saying, well, how do I do that? He says, well, you have priesthood authority. And so I believe it was the next year, sometime at least after the angel visit of 1834, that Joseph Smith was married using priesthood authority to, and this would have been authority he got from Peter, James, and John, that he used that to be sealed to Fanny probably in 1835.
And in his mind, not as an eternal marriage at the time.
Right. There are some allusions to there being eternal marriages in things written by W.W. Phelps in 1835, but there was no special ceremony or anything mentioned. How much Joseph knew, when he found it out. You know, some people say they have a good idea. I disagree. I don't think we have any idea when Joseph came to know all that he knew.
Okay, right.
Line upon line. But
yeah, I mean, it seems like this in his mind was some unfolding that where he kept increasing or becoming more specific about what he was revealing. But at any point in time, he had a real incomplete knowledge of what the end result would be.
Yeah, that's very good summary, I think.
Okay, so you were going to say two other things that Grant Palmer said about Fanny, is that right, or challenges he made?
Yeah, he said Joseph Smith did, and we just actually discussed the third one. Joseph Smith did not claim the power to bind on earth and seal in heaven eternally until Elijah appeared to himself in Oliver Cowdery in the Kirtland Temple. And I'm just saying that nobody claimed it was a sealing. Again, we're setting up a straw man here with that. Joseph clearly had, based upon his behavior in performing priesthood marriages, he had authority to perform a marriage and not a sealing at that time, and that's all he would have needed.
And I'll just say most Mormons are not going to envision the possibility of a polygamous marriage that is for time only. So, I mean, that's a fair thing to point out, but it's also fair for you to say that no one's technically claiming it as an eternal marriage, right?
Right, and we'll talk more about that. So,
okay, in our next episodes. Okay, what else you got?
The last one is simply that Fanny left the state and quickly rejected counsel by marrying a non-Mormon, something one would not expect from a Mormon plural wife. And this is really out there. first off, I would challenge him to find any counsel that was given to her. In fact, I think Joseph probably did counsel her to go ahead and leave him because Emma was making such a fuss about what was going on. As you read the few accounts that we have, Fanny is not upset with Joseph. She's being cast out by Emma, and Emma's having nothing to do with her. And so to say that Joseph didn't counsel her or that he told her to stick around is just undocumented. And again, I challenge Grant to document that. We know in Nauvoo, and this will be new to many of your listeners, that Joseph did allow one divorce from Flora Ann Woodworth. And that's a whole interesting story by itself. But, it isn't unprecedented in Joseph Smith's plural marriages for him to have said, okay, this isn't working out. You know, I'll undo this priesthood marriage that we have entered into. Also, you know, he says this is something one would not expect from a Mormon plural wife. Well, to compare her to any other plural wives, even in Nauvoo, is just very artificial. I mean, this was incredibly secret. When it was found out, it was rejected by many of the people closest to it. And to expect her to have hung around like a Mormon plural wife to me is just superimposing some really unrealistic expectations on this very first Kirtland plural marriage.
Given the fact that there was no sort of communal, I mean, there's probably little communal support for polygamous marriages in Nauvoo because it was so small, such an inner circle, and kept such secret. But back in 1835, 1836, there would be pretty much none, right?
Well, that's how I read it, John. Yeah, I like that the review. So
okay. So, all right. Well, I guess just to summarize, I'm going to go ahead and go back to the slide about your books, and I'm just going to say, Brian Hales again is coming out in just a few days with Greg Coford Books, a 3-volume set on Joseph Smith's polygamy. You can get it at Benchmark Books, at Coford Books, and at Amazon. Lloyd has asked me to publicize some book signings that are happening soon. So I'm going to go ahead and let everyone know that on February 26th, on February 27th, you will be speaking about your research and signing copies at Benchmark Books. We'll put the address up on the podcast at 5:30 and then at 7:30 at Pioneer Book in Orem. And then in March 9th at 7 p.m., you'll be doing a book signing as well. So it looks like there's 3 book signings coming up. I'll put the details to those book signings up. Will you be giving presentations or speeches before the book signing or not?
The Benchmark and Pioneer Book, I'm planning just to talk about how the books came to be. There won't be a PowerPoint, but also, which I'm excited for, Don Bradley, I think, is going to be at both of those. And we'll turn a bunch of time over to him because he did the research. He was the one looking at the dusty manuscripts and making the bigger books possible. And Don will be there, and we'll get to hear from him as well on this topic.
Okay, great. All right. And I'll just remind our listeners that our plan is for this to be sort of part 2 of a 4-part series, if you count the A Thoughtful Faith interview, where we're going to dig deeply into some of the myths about Joseph Smith's polygamy. And then also, you know, how you and others have kind of reconciled polygamy with their faith, not in an attempt to convince people to believe, but for those who desire to believe, just some frameworks for making this all work. How does that sound, Brian?
Sounds great. Thanks, John.
Okay. So, listeners, thanks for joining us. To check out the video for this, if you're just listening, it's at youtube.com/Mormon Stories. To discuss this podcast, go up to mormonstories.org and you'll find the episode there. Please leave comments for Brian. He's very interested in responding to as many as he can. If you or anyone else has evidence to, you know, sort of provide a counter evidence to Brian's discussion, you can post it there. We did ask Grant Palmer to be a part of this episode. He wasn't interested in the back and forth kind of thing, but that invitation's open as well to have Grant respond or to even bring Grant and Brian on for a conversation. So we invite that as well. But thanks to all the listeners for your support of Mormon Stories. And we look forward to the next episode. So, Brian Hales, thanks so much for coming on Mormon Stories.
Thank you, John.
All right.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. Music today was provided by the Saber Rattlers. Check them out at saber-rattlers.com. The Mormon Stories logo was generously donated by StudioCase.com. Thanks for listening.
Come, come, ye saints, no toil nor labor fear, but with joy wend your way. Though hard to you this journey may appear, grace shall be as your day. Tis better far to drive, do this and joy. Your hearts will swell, oh, all is well, all is well. Why should we mourn? I think our lot is hard, 'tis not so. just we shall dwell.